From the Moon Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. Good morning. I'm John Horn, in for Larry Mantle. Today, coming up, our critics will tell you about The Curse of La Llorona. It's a horror film based on the Mexican folk legend of the Weeping Woman. Also, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote. It's a comedic drama starring Adam Driver, directed by Terry Gilliam. And you'll also hear about the Disney documentary Penguins, about a penguin named Steve. All that coming up right here on Film Week. Hello, it's Film Week. I'm John Horn, host of The Frame on KPCC. I am sitting in for Larry Mantle today. We have lots of new releases to cover for you headed into the weekend. Plus, later on the show, we'll discuss about some notable movies that got stuck in the land where time stands still in Hollywood. It's called Development Hell, and we'll talk about some of the movies that escaped and a few of the movies that didn't. But first, reviews. Joining this week are Justin Chang, film critic for the LA Times, Claudia Puig, the president of the LA Film Critics Association, and our animation guru, Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. He also contributes to the LA Times. Welcome, one and all.
Thank you.
Hi, John.
Hello there. So we're going to start with The Curse of La Llorona. It's a horror film starring Linda Cardellini and Raymond Cruz. People will know him from Breaking Bad. It's written by Miki Daughtry and Tobias Iaconis and directed by Michael Chavez, who makes his feature directing debut. Claudia, I know how much you love to be scared. Were you scared by this movie?
Not enough. You know, this is a very important legend to those of us who are Latinos, and they really kind of rendered it toothless, which is a shame. They turned it into kind of a typical ghost story with all the things that, you know, you expect, tired horror movie tropes, things that go bump in the night. I will say it's a view of Los Angeles I've never seen. It was a very, very dark, stormy view of Los Angeles, which is something it seems like it would have been more befitting someplace in the East Coast. And it was set in 1973. The performances are good, but I just felt like I wanted more about the complexity of the original folk tale of La Llorona. You know, there, Michael Chavez, who you mentioned, the director, has, you know, a fairly deft touch at some of those scares, but, I appreciated that Spanish was interwoven into the narrative, and I appreciated that it didn't do, things like, hello, abuelita. Grandmother, the way you see, you know, just really nobody talks like that.
So is the legend more interesting than the film? What
the
is legend?
The legend is much more interesting. The legend is about this woman who, it's sort of told slightly differently in different versions, but it's basically this woman who was madly in love with this husband, this nobleman who he married beneath his station, and so he eventually leaves her. She's so upset. She gets revenge by drowning their two sons. And then she immediately feels remorse and she's crying and weeping and tries to get her children back, but it's too late. So the story or the folk legend that Latino parents use to kind of, scare their children straight. Yeah. Is to, you know, you better behave or La Llorona will come and get you and she'll come and you know, drown you.
And it sounds like the curse just went onto your laptop as you were talking
yes,
about
I
the
apologize
movie.
For that. La Llorona is cursing it.
On yeah. your film because you said bad things. The Curse of La Llorona stars Linda Cardellini, Patricia Velasquez, and Raymond Cruz. It's the feature directing debut of Michael Chavez. It's rated R and it is in wide release. Now we're going to talk about the comedic drama, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote. It's directed by Terry Gilliam, who co-wrote the screenplay with Tony Grissoni. Adam Driver and Jonathan Pryce star in the film, inspired by Cervantes' classic tale about a Spanish knight with dreams of grandiosity. Justin, why don't you get us started on Don Quixote?
Yeah, this is the final realization of a movie nearly 30 years in the making and unmaking, as it notes cheekily at the outset. This is Gilliam's extraordinarily ill-fated adaptation of the Cervantes novel. It was originally supposed to star Jean Rochefort and Johnny Depp, only to bog down in one epic mishap after another. Sets were destroyed by floods. Rochefort got sick. There were massive financial difficulties.
Johnny Depp got old.
Yes. They had to recast it in the end. There was this great documentary, Lost in La Mancha, made in 2002, which I remember seeing years ago. And now, here it is. And it's a bit of a relief after all that to watch this movie and say, this isn't that bad. It's not that, all things considered, it's not that good
You're
either.
You're praising with faint damn.
I can see it on the poster already. It's a bit of a relief though, because I think it suffers from a lot of the problems that Terry Gilliam movies do, even the ones that do not go so fantastically awry. It seems to be just flailing all over the screen. But there is a fascination, I think, in seeing how this movie more or less found its way. And now it stars Adam Driver, who plays this young director who's shooting a Don Quixote-themed TV commercial. It's very meta in Spain. And then a decade earlier, he was making this black and white arty student film, also of Don Quixote, and the guy who played him, who is played by Jonathan Pryce, has now gone mad. He's this village shoemaker, and he actually thinks he's Don Quixote. So much fitfully amusing, manically choreographed chaos ensues. Stellan Skarsgård and Olga Kurylenko are there. There's a lot of chaos, a lot of destruction. It's a Terry Gilliam movie. But I think that the strength of it is, for all its kind of lack of discipline, his affection for the material comes through. And there's feeling here. There's something personal. And I think this is, the story is one of someone falling under the spell of some grand delusion. And I think that actually is a very nice metaphor for Gilliam's as a filmmaker.
Claudia, what did you think?
I agree, generally. You expect it to be, you think it'll either be a catastrophe or a masterpiece, and it is neither. It's in that vast middle area. It is entertaining, sometimes exhausting, and it's uneven. It's not to the level of Brazil or The Adventures of Baron Munchausen or Fisher King or even 12 Monkeys, but it is... it's fitfully entertaining. I would say Jonathan Pryce is perfect in that role as Don Quixote. And I thought Adam Driver was really good, too. He showed more of his comic skills than we've seen.
To jump in, though, I'm not sure Don Quixote is filmable.
No,
Walt Disney tried to film it three times, and the studio tried again after he died. And the novel is so long and episodic and complicated, it just doesn't lend itself to a 2-hour movie.
I did like the locations. I thought they were beautiful in Spain.
That's like singing the scenery, I guess. Does Charles make a good point that maybe the problem in trying to adapt this novel is that it was unadaptable?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that he is kind of maybe the right match for it if it was adaptable, with his sort of sense of daffiness and goofiness and wittiness. But I think you're probably right.
And Justin, you said the Terry Gilliam movies that didn't go off the rails. is there one? I can't think of one.
Speaking of that, curses are quite the theme this week, I have to say. I saw this movie. It was closing night film of the Cannes Film Festival last year, which is kind of a cursed slot to begin with. A producer sued to attempt to block the screening. The Terry Gilliam had a health scare. Up until last minute, we were convinced like a meteor was going to strike the theater. So it didn't, but we saw the movie. So happy ending, I suppose.
Hopefully it doesn't strike today in the theaters. Yeah.
There have been a lot of movies where I wished a meteor had struck the theater before I went in.
Yeah.
The Man Who Killed Don Quixote is directed and co-written by Terry Gilliam, and it stars Adam Driver and Jonathan Pryce. The film is unrated, and you can see it at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset. Now we're going to talk about Penguins. It's a documentary from Disney that features narration by Ed Helms. Alistair Feathergill and Jeff Wilson co-directed the film, which was written by David Fowler. Charles.
Well, this is continuing a genre that Walt Disney actually invented right after World War II, which is you take a nature documentary, you find a way to make it about characters, so it's not just, footage of penguins or lions or seals. So it's very much in that tradition that won Disney a whole bunch of Oscars. In this case, they follow the supposedly one of the Adélie penguins who make this enormous journey to reach their nesting grounds. The males are all competing for space and rocks to make nests out of. The females arrive, they pair off. They have to raise the chicks in, weather that can turn bitterly cold and kill them at any moment with squaw gulls and leopard seals that are waiting to dine on them. It's entertaining. I think it's a little bit too cute in places. And I wish they had settled on a soundtrack for it, as one minute you've got this kind of bubblegum pop, then you've got sort of pseudo John Adams low strings when the leopard seal is around, then you've got people whistling, then you're back to another song. And it's distracting. The scenery is gorgeous. It's fun to watch the penguins as they waddle along. And yes, they do trip and fall and slide. Who doesn't think penguins are cute? So if you've got small children, this is a good film to take them to. And if you go during the first week, some of the money is earmarked for a wildlife fund that helps to protect penguins and serve other ecological causes.
in the scheme of documentaries about penguins, it feels like we've been there, done that.
Not nearly so dramatic as March of the Penguins, and of course, it doesn't have Morgan Freeman intoning the narration.
You don't have the voice of God. You have Ed Helms. Okay, yeah, so you're stepping down a little bit.
Quite a number of steps, but I mean, he does an okay job. It's just that again, it gets a little too cute in places. You know, it's easy to make jokes about penguins regurgitating to feed their chicks, and all right, that's kind of an obvious laugh.
Penguins is co-directed by Alistair Fothergill and Jeff Wilson. It features narration by Ed Helms. It's rated G, and you can see it in select theaters, so check your local listings. Now we're going to talk about Long Day's Journey into Night. It's the Chinese-French drama from writer-director Gan Bi. Justin, Claudia, who wants to start?
I will start with this one. This has nothing to do with Eugene O'Neill. The actual Chinese title translates to Last Evenings on Earth, which is a reference to a short story collection by Roberto Bolaño. This is the most magical movie I think I've seen this year.
Wow.
And I say magic because I don't want to kind of not to bury the lead. Halfway through this movie, this is a bifurcated narrative. There is an hour-long sequence that is being shown in 3D, and you should at the Landmark, actually, and you should see it in 3D at all costs if you can. It is a nearly hour-long tracking or traveling shot done in one take and done the analog way with no digital – truly one of the most magical things I've seen in a movie theater. And the story around it is pretty magical too. It is about a man who returns to his hometown, Kaili City, in China's Guizhou province, which is also director Bi Gan's hometown. And he is – his father has died, and he has come back and is sifting through his memories. He is haunted by the memory of the woman he loved and who has long since disappeared, haunted by the memory of a childhood friend who died at the hands of a gangster. The plot is almost incomprehensible because there's a layering of memories and flashbacks and dreams. This is the dreamiest movie in a while. It's very much in the key of Wong Kar-wai, with just fabulous colors and exquisite visual design and a lush mood of regret. Arty, I think, is the word. I don't like that word, but it's kind of no escaping it with this one. But it's also David Lynch. It's also borrows from the great Thai filmmaker Apichatpong Weerasethakul. It's also Andrei Tarkovsky. Bi Gan is a 28-year-old Chinese filmmaker, a wunderkind, who is very show-offy in his technique. I was completely held rapt by this movie. It casts a spell. It is technical genius. It is pure poetry.
And when you're in the middle of a tracking shot that is that long, at what point do you start to notice that they haven't made a cut? Because sometimes some people don't notice, and sometimes you say, wait, I don't think I've seen a cut for the last minute. And then you look at your watch, and it's an hour later.
It's true. That shot mimics a dream state. And there are times when you can tell probably, okay, yeah, they're distracting you a little bit over here while they're setting up the scene somewhere else. And there's one part where they're playing table tennis and they're playing billiards. But it's like, wait, it kind of – the success of the scene depends on a certain outcome with the game. So there are little tricks like that where you're like – oh, the suspense. But most of the time, it's just this drift. It's a wonderfully drifty movie that you get lost in.
You're so caught up in it. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know what more I can add to that, but it's so evocative. It's so impressionistic. It's disorienting, and it's very languidly paced, but it is hypnotically watchable. It's probably the most oblique and mysterious movie I've ever seen. My advice is to sort of see it and don't worry about following the plot, and just let the sort of sense of wonderment and confusion, dreamlike confusion, wash over you and succumb. It is I was one of those that did not really realize how long that cutless scene was because I was so caught up in it. It plays with time in a way that we haven't seen before. It kind of follows the closest thing I could think of is like the logic of dreams, where they make perfect sense when you're dreaming and then you wake up and they, of course, don't. In the cold light of morning, they sort of evaporate. Yeah. And I like the humidity of it. Like he goes to this tropical part of China and there's water everywhere and it feels so redolent of symbolism. I have to say, I kind of want to see it again to maybe understand it more. Maybe I never will, but I still appreciate it.
And there's another film that we should mention, Birdman, which relied largely on long takes without cuts? Does it feel as immersive as that film was?
Well, this movie is actually good, so, you know. I can't a little bit. I don't hate Birdman. It's interesting because Birdman did that all through lots of digital trickery and editing.
And you
and
felt
visual
the
effects.
Trickery. You felt it. Yeah.
It goes there. Long Day's Journey into Night is a Chinese-French film directed by Bi Gan. It's unrated. You can see it at the Lemley's Playhouse in Pasadena and the Landmark Theater in West L.A. Coming up, we're going to review Worlds of Ursula Le Guin. It's a documentary about the legendary author. We'll also hear about the documentary Hail Satan, which takes a look at members of a satanic temple and is really about religious freedom. We'll be back with more Film Week in just a minute. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm John Horn, sitting in today for Larry Mantle. We're joined by critics Justin Chang, Claudia Puig, and Charles Solomon. Next up, Worlds of Ursula K. Le Guin. It's from first-time writer-director Arwen Curry. The film features interviews with and archive footage of the acclaimed fiction writer. Charles, I know she was a good friend of yours. Tell us about the film and about your relationship.
Well, I apologize in advance if my voice cracks, because I still miss Ursula very much. This is a very warm, very respectful, and very accurate portrait of this writer. She worked with the filmmaker up until the last part of her life, and much of the footage is assembled from events that took place years apart. She was a woman of iron convictions, and she believed that fantasy and science fiction should not be lumped off at the edge of respectability as genre, and she saw no reason for women to be reduced to pawns, either as writers or as characters in this kind of literature, and she basically revolutionized that kind of writing, bringing it more into the mainstream, introducing feminist elements, and you see both her humor and those iron convictions, including her speech at when she received the National Book Award and took on Amazon, and she said that, you know, books are not commodities. Very typical of her way of thinking. It's a lovely portrait, and it made me cry because it reminded me how much I miss her.
In addition to people wanting to see the movie, if they're interested in her work, what books would you recommend they read?
Oh, gee, she wrote so many. Earthsea was my introduction to her work, when it was for many, and there are now, I think there are altogether six books in that series. Lathe of Heaven, even the book she wrote on writings, Steering the Craft, very valuable book for aspiring writers or pro writers who just want a little tutoring. She wrote children's books. I miss her emails more than anything, frankly.
And you talked about your cat with her.
Oh, yes. Yeah, she loved cats. And we would, I used to mail her catnip from our garden, and I'd get back little drawings of her cat saying, "What was in that package?"
Worlds of Ursula K. Le Guin is a documentary. It's written and directed by Arwen Curry. It's unrated, and you can see it at Lemley's Glendale this weekend and at Lemley's Playhouse, Royal Town Center, and Claremont starting on Monday. Next, the documentary Hail Satan, with a question mark. It's from director Penny Lane. It features interviews with members of the Satanic Temple as they organize a series of public actions designed to advocate for religious freedom. Claudia, why don't you get us started?
Well, the question mark at the end of the title is key. This is a very witty, smart, eye-opening, and entertaining documentary. The Satanic Temple is not really about Lucifer, and it's about – it's not really even about shock, as you think when you hear the word Satan anywhere. It's about their provocative stunts that really were intended to shed light on the separation between church and state. This group inserts themselves – into almost any situation in which the imposition of Christianity in government or public schools is put forth. So their first effort was in 2013 when Oklahoma wanted to put a statue of the Ten Commandments on the lawn on the state capitol, and they countered it by insisting they put a statue of Baphomet, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, a winged goat man that symbolizes something devilish that I don't know anything about. But you know, they also, Penny Lane does a really good job, I think, of making this very, it's weird to say light when you're talking about Satan in any way, but it's not about Satan. And it's very entertaining. It's really about religious plurality. And it's, you know, the seven tenets of the Satanic Temple are you should strive to act with compassion and your belief should conform to scientific knowledge. And, you know, I came home and I told my husband, I think I'm a Satanist.
Well, because we should make clear that in this film, people are not being burned alive at the stake. No. The members of the Satanic Temple are actually going into classrooms and doing civic work. And I saw this film at the Sundance Film Festival. It is really about you cannot, as a government, federal, state, local, favor one religion over
exactly.
another.
Yeah.
And if you're going to put up something that favors Christianity, by
law, yeah.
you have to put up something yeah. that favors
the,
Satan.
I would also point out Claudia did not sacrifice her husband on that altar.
Not yet.
I just have to say, watching this as a Christian, I appreciate the epic troll of releasing this movie on Good Friday.
Yes.
Love that. And, you know, as a Christian who believes quite strongly in the separation of church and state, I really enjoyed this movie. I was never affronted by it. I think when they read the seven tenets of the Satanic Temple, it is hard, I think, for a reasonable person to argue with any of them.
Yeah.
They emphasize compassion and empathy, fighting for justice, submitting to science and reason, striving for reconciliation. These should be tenets of Christianity and other religions as well. And so it's interesting, though, they avail themselves of the iconography of Satan in order to make a politically combative statement.
Provocateurs.
Yeah.
It's a provocateur's
yeah.
performance
it's,
artist.
It's secular yeah. humanism taken to a loopy horror comic extreme.
Exactly.
Yes. Basically.
Exactly.
We should also talk about the person at the center of the film, Lucian Greaves, who is
yeah.
not his real name,
yes.
and apparently a pseudonym for
not
his real name.
Yes.
But he's also a very interesting character in the way he presents himself and the arguments that he finds himself making. And he is very reluctant in this battle, but he feels that he is compelled to represent, I think, all religions, not just Satanic Temple.
Yeah, he's very thoughtful, and he is reluctant to thrust himself as forward as the face of the movement, although he eventually comes to realize that this is his life's work, and he cares about it too much to let anyone else do it for him. I think one of the most revealing things in this movie happens is when a woman who runs a local chapter of the temple becomes...
In Detroit, yeah.
she actually does start staging these elaborate rituals involving nudity and whatnot. And she goes a little, and she actually, I think, gets excommunicated, basically.
Well, she espouses violence, and they do not espouse
She espouses violence.
Violence. Yeah. Yeah.
And it becomes this very funny and poignant comment on the idea that even Satanists have to deal with growing pains and factionalism and bureaucratic issues.
And there's this
speech. Not really.
And I think there's a speech at the beginning of the film where Lucian Greaves is speaking, and some heckler says, "I hope you go to hell." And he thinks, "I certainly hope so."
And I love their black robes, and they wear these like silly Halloween horns on their heads, and you know, it's very low tech in that respect too.
The documentary is called "Hail Satan" with a question mark, not an exclamation point. It's directed by Penny Lane. It's rated R. You can see it at the ArcLight Hollywood and the Landmark Theater in West LA. Now we're going to continue with Her Smell. It's a drama starring Elizabeth Moss, Cara Delevingne, and Amber Heard. Alex Ross Perry wrote and directed the film. It's about a self-destructive punk rocker. That seems redundant. Struggling with sobriety while trying to recapture the creativity that once shot her band to success.
That also Who sounds was? Redundant.
Yeah, I know. Okay. Claudia, you want to get us going?
I think I'm less high on this than Justin, so we'll start with the
okay.
negative, I guess. I think there is very little that Elizabeth Moss cannot do. I will start with that. I think that, you know, whether she's playing the amazing character in Handmaid's Tale, you know, or in The Square, she had a tiny little part, but it was key. Of course, Peggy and Mad Men. And then this very underappreciated film, The One I Love, where she was really great. She's wonderful in this role. And we've seen this kind of Courtney Love-esque character. We've seen it as a man a lot. We've seen it as Kurt Cobain. And we just haven't seen it as a woman. So I think that's
and
really
in a Star
interesting.
Is born.
Yeah, yeah. Right. We've seen it a million times. I mean, you can name them. It's a genre unto itself. There's a claustrophobic feeling to this. There's kind of an airless quality to feeling to it, almost suffocating, but it's always compelling. I did find it always so watchable. There's also the hectic pandemonium of sort this, of what surrounds her.
I'm glad you found it compelling. I certainly did, too. This is a movie that will summon kind of your fight or flight instincts because it is Alex Ross Perry who I say this as a compliment because the word abrasive is usually used as an insult, but I mean it absolutely as a compliment. He revels in exploring the darkest aspects kind of the human condition, I would say. And Elizabeth Moss is right there alongside him. And this is their third collaboration after Listen Up, Philip and Queen of Earth, where she was also brilliant. This is, I think, one of the great performances of the year. She is just lacerating, furious to watch, furiously eloquent, too. What's interesting is she's an interesting character. So even as she's falling apart, the language in this movie is, her diction is like, I can't even describe it.
You
she
know,
uses alliteration.
Bothered me a little bit. I felt like that felt very.
It might pull you out.
Yes,
it can
it
pull
felt too
you
written,
out. It is
they
very
use the
written.
Word ignominious. I
it
mean,
is.
She, I'm not sure grunge rockers would do that.
No, it's not. And I think there's an interesting tension, I think, between the intense realism that he's creating and there's a poetic element
yes.
too.
It's stagey.
There is a level of pretension to it. Alex Ross Perry has said that he is, you know, inspired by Shakespeare and Guns N' Roses,
oh,
and the movie is a
definitely.
Five act. You know,
I got Shakespearean feel
oh,
to it,
it's,
especially
it's
the part during the in the recording studio. I thought there was all kinds of
the three witches, you
yes,
know, who are played by Cara Delevingne is one of them. These three kind of up and coming punk sprites who she woos in, and because her bandmates can't stand her anymore, and they've all left. So this is a movie where she is basically treating everyone on screen terribly for more than 2 hours, almost 2 hours, but there is a measure of redemption too, and the entire cast is so good. Virginia Madsen plays her mother, who is basically like forever apologizing for having brought this monster into the world. Dan Stevens as her ex-boyfriend. I think top to bottom, this is a superbly written and directed film.
And the cinematography I thought was amazing too. Sort of the way it swirls around and her kind of unsteadiness, you pick that up, and then the close-ups of her smudged face. And I think the abrasive character though is something that people will find more abrasive because it's a woman. There's a little bit of sexism. It may be in the way people will view it.
Next up is Fast Color. It's a sci-fi drama starring Gugu Mbatha-Raw, Lorraine Toussaint. Julia Hart directed the film and is also a co-screenwriter along with Jordan Horowitz. Justin, why don't you get us going on this one?
Yeah, I think this is a terrific movie that juggles several different genres with enormous skill and economy. It's a multi-generational family drama. It's a kind of indie superhero origin story set in a dystopian future. There's a horrible drought. Water is rationed very carefully. Gugu Mbatha-Raw plays Ruth, a woman who we find out is a recovering addict, and she's constantly on the run. She suffers these seizures that have the power to trigger earthquakes. And eventually she makes her way back to the home that she left years ago, where her mother, played by the wonderful Lorraine Toussaint, is caring for Ruth's young daughter. And we learn that these women have this telekinetic power, this ability to bend and shape matter with their minds, which allows for some visual effects which are very skillfully and sparingly deployed. I was really moved by this film. It would not be inaccurate to call it a celebration of mothers and daughters or a celebration of Black womanhood in particular. It's very empowering in that respect, but I don't think it ever gets heavy or sanctimonious about it. You're just watching these women who have all been through a lot and weathered it and who are learning to tap into their extraordinary potential.
I completely agree.
Claudia, no.
I think there's a lot to like about this. It's a quiet movie, and some of it is very lo-fi in terms of the special effects, but so powerful, beautifully shot. The visuals are gorgeous. The music is really evocative as well, a score by Bob Simonson. Gugu Mbatha-Raw is excellent. Lorraine Toussaint is amazing as her estranged mother. And the young girl, so it's generational about mothers and daughters, and the youngest, who is Gugu Mbatha-Raw's daughter, Saniya Sidney, who we last saw in Fences, I thought was also really good. And the director, Julia Hart, shows a very assured hand, I think.
She's terrific.
She's fantastic. These are three strong women, and the way, you know, the allegory and mystery is woven in and what it says about motherhood, I thought was really powerful.
Fast Color is the film from director and co-writer Julia Hart. It's rated PG-13. You can see it at the ArcLight in Sherman Oaks and the Cinemark in Crenshaw. I should have said Hurstmel, which is directed and written by Alex Ross Perry, is rated R. It's playing at the ArcLight Hollywood. More reviews are coming up on Film Week with critics Justin Chang, Claudia Puig, and Charles Solomon, including the drama Little Woods from first-time director Nia DaCosta and a documentary about the first female film director. We're back in just a few minutes. It's Film Week. Welcome back. I'm John Horn, the host of The Frame. I'm sitting in for Larry Mantle today with critics Claudia Puig, Charles Solomon, and Justin Chang. Our next movie is called Little Woods. It's an Australian-U.S. co-production written and directed by Nia DaCosta, who makes her feature writing and directing debut. Tessa Thompson and Lily James star as estranged sisters who reconnect after their mother dies and have to quickly settle the mortgage on her house or face foreclosure. Claudia, why don't you start us on Little Woods?
I like this film. I thought it was a taut and also affecting thriller. It's kind of low key. It's about sisters being pushed to the extremes, and it's in this kind of really interesting little fracking boomtown in North Dakota, which is something we've not seen in the movies too much. The lead character, Tessa Thompson, I think she's a terrific actress, and she's good in lots of different genres, whether she's in Thor or Dear White People or Creed or Sorry to Bother You. She's just always good. So she's the emotional center of the film, and I think that's what makes it. Her sister is played by Lily James, and it's basically a story about women where men are kind of at the fringes of things, which I also kind of appreciated. And it's the feature debut of what I think is a very talented writer-director, Nia DaCosta. She really manages to capture this sort of bleak setting. I think the landscapes are striking. Yeah. There's kind of a desaturated palette. It reminded me a little bit of like Deborah Granik's work, Winter's Bone, maybe Frozen River a little bit too.
That kind of bleak, textured, very lived-in portrait of poor middle America.
Exactly.
I mean, this is – and Tessa Thompson's character, she's been busted for smuggling pills across the border from Canada because to take care of her terminally ill mother, who is now gone. And so she and her sister and Lily James's character's son, so her niece, are just – they're all they have pretty much in this world. And Tessa Thompson's character is at the end of her probation. So, of course, she's about to – one more week. And, of course, in a movie like this, she's got to make one last trip across the border due to desperate circumstances because Lily James's character is pregnant again. And so the tension, though, is very real in the film.
Yes,
and I think the performances are really good, and they get you past the occasional contrivance or implausibility of the story.
The film is called Little Woods. It stars Tessa Thompson and Lily James. Nia DaCosta wrote and directed the film. It's rated R. And it's playing at the New Art Theater. Next up, Be Natural, The Untold Story of Elise Guy Blaché. It's a documentary directed by Pamela B. Green, who co-wrote the film with Joan Simon. It tells the story of the first female director. Justin, Charles, who wants to go?
I'll jump in. I think this is a fascinating story, although it's only an interesting account of it. Madame Blaché was not only the first female director, she was one of the first directors of film, period. And her work had largely been forgotten for a variety of reasons. The films themselves were scattered long ago. And the interviews they found with her are fascinating. She's charming, she's articulate, she's witty, and you wish there were more of them. There are too many talking heads saying, never heard of her. There are these very self-conscious graphics of, oh, well, we found a great-nephew living here. Here's a line on a map showing where we went to get this material about her. They're also not entirely accurate when they say that she was creating cinema in isolation, in addition to all the innovative work that was being done in the theater at that time in France. There were also pre-filmic animation shows that were exploring some of these techniques, the Théâtre Optique of Émile Reynaud and the very elaborate shadow shows at the Chat Noir Cabaret that were far more sophisticated than anything being done in film then. But she is a fascinating figure. It's wonderful to see her restored. Her film, the clips of her films look intriguing, and I wish they had just found her talking and done that for 2 hours.
Claudia, you liked it a little bit more?
I did. She was an amazing person. She wrote, directed, produced 1,000 films. And her body of film is greater than the Lumiere's.
It's like Nicolas Cage.
Only they look better.
Only good, no. She was just, and also she was incredibly innovative. She was one of the first to use color and sync sound. She also made a film with an all-black cast, A Fool and His Money. And she's been largely written out of history, which I think is incredibly sad. And I really appreciate that they're trying to, educate all of us. And it starts off as kind of a biography. It has moments where it feels like a detective thriller. It definitely piques your interest about her work. And it also, there's some little side notes. For instance, I never knew that New Jersey was the original home of film before it moved to Hollywood, thanks to Edison.
You know, I actually visited Otto Messmer in Fort Lee.
Oh, interesting.
You're the creator of Felix the Cat.
Yeah, it was Fort Lee, New Jersey. Yeah. That was the Hollywood of before Hollywood. And it's, you know, yes, I could have done with a little bit less of the all the filmmakers and people saying, you know, never heard of her. And the only two that did were Ava DuVernay and Gail Ann Hurd. Even Peter Bogdanovich, who said, you know, I wrote books about film history. He'd never heard of her either. But
it's a little bit disingenuous because, you know, how many silent filmmakers apart from the Lumiere brothers and Méliès would they have been able to name?
Yeah.
That said, you know, I agree. There are points when this movie seems to be getting in its own way, but it's got a wonderful subject. It brings it's as a piece of scholarship, as an insight into the work of a very important pioneering figure.
It is
absolutely valuable.
Yes.
And what I like about it, especially, is that it captures this fleeting moment of almost innocence near the time of the dawn of cinema, when directing was not automatically assumed to be a man's job, and where women directing a film was no big deal. And it was partly because cinema was this sort of ragtag renegade activity that wasn't taken seriously, wasn't expected to become a business or a lasting art form.
They thought it was a fad, yeah.
And eventually, of course, became industrialized and overrun by men, and Guy Blaché and other women pioneers were pushed out and ran out of history.
And she trained a lot of men and taught them.
And she had an influence on Eisenstein. She had an influence on a young Hitchcock. I mean, it's... Yeah, it's worth seeing.
Yeah, I think it's in many ways it's a revelation.
It is.
The film is called Be Natural. It's the untold story of Elise Guy Blaché. It's directed by Pamela B. Green. It's unrated, and you can see it at Lemley's Monica Film Center. Now, Under the Silver Lake, it's a comedic drama written and directed by David Robert Mitchell. It stars Andrew Garfield, Riley Keough, and Topher Grace. Justin, why don't you start on this one?
I go back and forth on this movie, which is extremely...
Depending on the day, the hour, the minute?
The minute. I liked it this morning and I hate it now. It's extremely self-indulgent and self-consciously weird and undisciplined. But it is I think it's a failure made by someone with a lot of talent, as David Robert Mitchell's previous films, The Myth of the American Sleepover and It Follows, bear out. And here he has made this epic Los Angeles neo-noir that cribs and riffs openly on everything from LA Confidential to Mulholland Drive to Kiss Me Deadly. You know, it stars Andrew Garfield as a slacker sleuth who is basically wasting his life away in this Silver Lake apartment that he's about to be evicted from. Then a young woman, played by Riley Keough, comes into his life and immediately disappears, and he becomes obsessed with finding her, and he becomes convinced that it's part of this vast and nefarious underground conspiracy linked to subliminal mind control messages that are being transmitted to us through our entertainment media. I'm trying to give you a sense of the texture of this movie. Weird things are happening.
Although it's much slower than the way you just
It actually is. That's the thing. There are long, flat, indulgent stretches to it, too,
yes.
Where the movie is trying to get you to be lost in this sort of twilight zone of Los Angeles, where Garfield's character is this sort of scruffy millennial riff on Elliot Gould in The Long Goodbye. And he becomes convinced that there are clues to the mysteries of the universe in cereal boxes and video
songs,
game magazines, and also, yes, the lyrics of hit pop songs.
Claudia, do you go back and forth on this one
as
well?
No,
I don't know if Justin,
I don't
know if you're
negative.
Talking yourself in or out of liking this. You stay negative. You're consistent.
I'm not consistent.
What did you not like?
It felt half-baked to me. I just felt like, you know, yes, I appreciated sort of the LA locations. It was nice being able to say, oh, look, there's, you know, Echo Park or there's whatever. But it just felt really very self-indulgent and just scattershot and half-baked. Garfield is a very likable actor. And I think the character was not nearly as likable as he made him be in a way. I just maybe it was well-intentioned to try to create all those noir connections. Rear Window is another one, but really, instead of being kind of Rear Window, as he's basically just a kind of a sleazy peeping Tom as opposed to Jimmy Stewart. But it just didn't work for me at all.
The film is Under the Silver Lake. It's from writer director David Robert Mitchell. It stars Andrew Garfield. It's rated R. You can see it at the ArcLight Hollywood. Coming up next, we're going to talk about notable films that got stuck in development hell. Following the release this week of The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, Terry Gilliam's movie, which spent 25 years in the making, might not have been worth it, according to our critics. But we'll be back in just 1 minute. It's Film Week. I'm John Horn, host of The Frame. I am sitting in today for Larry Mantle. Lawsuits, bankruptcy, flash floods. Those are just some of the reasons why movies end up in development hell. It's the film industry's term for some of the most unlucky movie productions. As we mentioned earlier in the hour, today marks the release of one such film, nearly three decades in the making, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote. Director Terry Gilliam first tried to film it in 2000 with Johnny Depp and Jean Rochefort in the lead roles, only to have the production quickly shut down by a series of mishaps. With me to talk about notably troubled film productions are our KPCC critics, president of the LA Film Critics Association, Claudia Puig, Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, and Justin Chang from the LA Times. So we have three basic categories here: films that were delayed, films that were never made, and films that weren't released. Is there a common denominator of why movies tend to end up in development hell? Justin.
I don't know that there is among those three categories. I mean, I just think it you know, movies are hard to make, and I think we're fortunate when even a mediocre movie is the product of enormous, I think, improbabilities and coming into alignment
and
magically.
Nobody sets out to make a mediocre movie.
So, but,
though they often achieve it.
They do indeed. I think taking just some of the movies that were never made or even the ones that were held up in their release and or released in a drastically altered form, outsized ambition is often a quality. You know, I think of a film like Kenneth Lonergan's Margaret, which is attempting something much more dramatically complex than the usual adult drama, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think ambition in an industry that tries to stifle it is a bad thing. Mm. And so thinking about films like Kubrick's Napoleon or Jodorowsky's Dune, hello. What am I thinking?
That's the one that was really stressed.
Yes.
Got my J's mixed up. It's, you know, these are or Orson Welles's Heart of Darkness. And
Or The Other Side of the Wind.
Which
I mean, it feels
finally
like
came out last year.
Yes.
So, yeah.
I think the record for time may be Destino. That was the short that Salvador Dali and Disney collaborated on that was started in, I think, 1946 and released in 2003.
Sometimes it seems like the meddling of studios, too. You know, people getting in there and putting too many hands involved, too many people involved, and you know, the mucking up of, you know, in the old days people would talk about Harvey Scissorhands. But, it, you know, there's just people... Too many people getting involved and maybe the impeding the director's vision. Too many executives impeding the director's vision.
Well, I remember having a conversation with Glenn Close about The Wife, which was a movie that took, I think, 5 years to get made. And she had made a movie called Albert Nobbs that she had produced and starred in. And I think she spent a decade working on that film. And it was an example, to my mind, of a movie that could never get enough traction. It couldn't get financing. It couldn't get a distributor. It was what a lot of people who are behind it thought was a good idea, but it could not attract the right kind of people, which are the people writing checks. And I think that might also be a common denominator for a lot of these films. For whatever reason, the studio, the producer, the production company doesn't see a reason to sign off. And so these movies just kind of on their gopher cage wheel where they're spinning around and never getting anywhere.
Especially if it's kind of a more of an intimate drama, the way Albert Nobbs was, or the way Margaret was, as opposed to maybe if you say to somebody, oh, Don Quixote, then they'll think, yeah, you know, there could be something to that. Yeah, exactly. But if it's something that's a little offbeat or seems very intimate and requires either a lot of money or a lot of time, yeah, who are you going to get to
finance
that?
Or if it's something really new, people told Walt Disney, nobody could sit through an hour and a half of animation. There's no point in making Snow White.
And then there's some movies that I think have been made that maybe shouldn't be seen. I'm thinking of the Jerry Lewis movie, The Day the Clown Cried.
Which hasn't really been seen. But
well, I think some footage leaked out briefly. And then for people who don't know, who would give us a little primer on Jerry Lewis, Holocaust comedy, The Day the Clown Cried?
This was going to be a biopic about a famous European clown who was used to entertain children at Auschwitz before they were killed. Not a movie I'm going to rent out and see, but the story that I had heard, and I don't know for sure that it's true, is that he had started making it and didn't realize that the man's widow was still alive and controlled the rights to his story. And she saw some of the footage and said no. And that's been it. But it's not something I can imagine anyone wanting to watch.
On the other hand, I'm just thinking of something like Amazing Grace, which was, you know, a documentary that was...
This is the Aretha Franklin film, yes, which just now came out.
And it's wonderful.
It's absolutely wonderful. It's wonderful. And thank goodness that it finally saw the light of day.
One of the reasons that one was it was actually a technical error because Sidney Pollack, who was directing it, they didn't have a slate to sync the sound of the picture. And as a result of that, you had this footage, which was kind of really impossible to put together. And so this painstaking effort, and finally it exists, and happily so.
Yeah.
You know?
No, and obviously there are often legal issues that surround films that for whatever reason, the production company, the distributor, it could have been a Weinstein Company film, the company goes under. And then there are movies, I'm not going to say the title, there's a Rolling Stones documentary from 1972. The last word of the title is Blues. This is a movie that has been surrounded by legal problems. And I think that's a movie, unlike the Jerry Lewis Holocaust comedy, that actually might be interesting. I know some people have seen it. Whatever happens to this film, Blank Blues? Justin, do you think it'll ever come out?
Oh, I don't know. It's beyond but I know that some people have seen it too. But yeah, no.
And what about the movies that have been in development hell that haven't been made? The filmmakers who tried to make something that actually sounded good on paper and were never able to pull it off. Anything come to mind that you wish had been made that you could have seen?
You go, Charles.
There was... In the late 1930s, Sam Goldwyn and Walt Disney talked about making a biopic of Hans Christian Andersen, where Goldwyn would do the live action and the fairy tales would be animated. And the development art for that was just drop-dead gorgeous, like a scene where he would be pouring tea for Jenny Lind. The camera would move in on the design on the porcelain teapot that would animate and become the director's nightingale. And apparently that got derailed by World War II. And then years later, Goldwyn made that biopic with Danny Kaye.
And Justin, you mentioned something that Stanley Kubrick wanted to do. What was that?
Oh, yeah. Napoleon, his epic biopic of that, you know, that one, which, but, you know, Kubrick being Kubrick, just so bogged down in the minutia.
He works so fast, too.
I say that with utmost admiration because he's one of the greatest filmmakers. But, you know, so... His insistence on verisimilitude, the movie just never, you know, he was so busy with the research and with the lavish recreation that it never got off the ground. In a completely different direction, I'm kind of sad that we'll never get Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian, the Beetlejuice sequel that Tim Burton first commissioned in 1990 and was revived briefly in 2011 with possibly, apparently, Michael Keaton and Winona Ryder returning. But no, as of this month, I think it has been shelved.
But it's going to be a stage musical.
Okay, so we'll get to see him.
Claudia, well, sometimes they do appear in other forms like that, which
perhaps
is
a more hospitable format.
I know my co-host, A. Martinez, is very hopeful that the movie version of Flash gets made. I don't know if it will escape from development hell, but Claudia, do you have a film that you are crossing your fingers for or something that
is... I've heard there was going to be a remake of The Crow, which is a movie I loved way back when. I'd be very... And the latest incarnation supposedly had Jason Momoa as the tragic hero. I think that's sort of interesting. But I feel like almost any Orson Welles movie falls into that category, too. So, you know, sometimes it's you're talking about ambition, which is something we really admire. But sometimes it's just difficult directors, too. So there's a combination of so many factors.
Or difficult material.
Difficult material, yes.
And Don Quixote. We're back to Don
Quixote.
Yes,
we are
right.
Back to Don Quixote. is it for Film Week. I'm John Horn. I'm sitting in today for Larry Mantle. I want to thank our KPCC film critics, Justin Chang, film critic for the LA Times, Claudia Puig, president of the LA Film Critics Association, and our animation guru, Charles Solomon, who writes for the LA Times, Animation Scoop, and Animation Magazine. Everybody, go out and see some of these movies, maybe avoid some of the others. Have a great weekend.